We got your front, too, but I don't mean that in an inappropriate way at all. It's 6:14, Tommy Tucker, WWL, hot human today, chance for showers as always. And Todd Bell joins us, professor and director of the political management program at George Washington University, to talk about Elon Musk and his plans, he says, to create a third party. How you doing, professor?
Doing well, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. You know, I always thought that a third party, I didn't know if it was ever viable or not, but then I got to thinking about Elon Musk, and I got to thinking about, well, maybe it might be. Then I got to thinking about, well, I don't know if I want him starting a third party. I don't know where you want to start with this. First of all, what is his citizenship status? I'm trying to figure out. He's an American citizen or he's not?
He is an American citizen, but Elon Musk is not able to run for president because he was born in South Africa. So he would not be a candidate for president under their new party.
So when it comes to starting a party or whatever, does citizenship have anything to do with any of that at all?
Not really. No. What you have to do when you're starting a party is you need to get registered in the different states and get on the ballot. And the way you do that is each state actually has different regulations. Some states it's easier than others, but it usually requires you to go around and get signatures. Most political parties, if they reach a certain threshold at the last election, they're automatically on the ballot in the following election. But if you want to get on the ballot as a new party, you have to go around and get signatures so that your candidates can get recognized in the primary and general elections.
When we talk about third party, do we normally think presidential race? But would that be where the biggest opening would be for a third party, or would it be with Congress? Or tell me about that, Professor.
Interestingly not. It's a great question. And the history of third parties in the United States, until recently, we've had a couple third parties that actually replaced other parties. We had the Whig Party replace the Federalist Party back in the 1800s and such. But since we've had our modern system of elections of senators and members of the House, it's extremely difficult for third parties to win either in Congress or in the presidency. Now, they have had some success in the U.S. Senate. You've got Bernie Sanders, who ostensibly is a Democrat, but calls himself an independent. He was never a Democrat until he ran for president in 2016. And Angus King from Maine, who is an independent. So they are ostensibly third-party candidates who have been able to win. Had a couple others here and there in the House. But for the most part, third-party candidates don't win in the United States because we have structural impediments to their victory. And that includes, compared to other democracies around the world, we have what's called the first-past-the-post system, also known as plurality elections. In most states where you don't need a majority, you just need to get the most votes. It can be a plurality, less than 50%, but as long as you get the most, you get the seat. We also do not have multi-member districts at the House level. That would mean you have 3 members from each district or 5 members from each district, which would give more opportunities to third parties. And we don't have what's called proportional representation, where you go to a place like Germany, where you see a lot of third parties having power. If you vote for the party and they get proportion of the legislature based upon the percentage they get in the election, we don't have that here. So all of this comes together to give a real advantage, not an exclusive win, but a real advantage to the two-party system, because it's difficult for a third party to surmount some of those obstacles. And of course, those obstacles are very similar at the presidential level, because you're counting the votes with the Electoral College, which is representatives and senators. So it's hard to win an actual state. The last time we had somebody win an actual state, I believe, was George Wallace back in the 1968 election, which was a very interesting election. So not likely. Remember, Ross Perot got 19% of the votes back in 1992 and didn't get a single electoral vote. So it just goes to show you, even though you can run up some popularity, it's extremely difficult to translate that into electoral success.
So when it comes to U.S. House of Representatives, U.S. Senate, there are rules that transcend states. Every state has the same rules because it's a federal election in terms of who can qualify.
Right.
Take me through that.
Yeah, in the House and the Senate right now, there's a, what really gives rise to the one party, I'm sorry, the two-party system, is that you have single-member districts and no proportional representation. Now, it is true that you have two senators per state, but they almost never run at the same time, unless there's a vacancy. So you usually have just one that you're choosing, which means it's probably going to be a Republican or a Democrat. For the for a third party to try to surmount both of the major parties is exceptionally difficult.
Let me take a break. We come back. I want to talk about money and where that figures into this. I don't think Ross Perot, and I might be wrong, I don't think Ross Perot had Elon Musk money, and Elon likes to, you know, have a lot of attention toward him, and I guess we all do, so I'm not criticizing him for that, but I don't know how serious he is about this and what exactly he would be standing for. And also, Professor, when we come back, I want to talk about the, I guess, the strategery involved in this where can you do it with baby steps where maybe you just win a key Senate seat there or a key House win there, and then before you know it, the majority's not what it once was, and then you start developing a little bit of momentum, and before you know it, you got a full-fledged third party. Maybe I'm just dreaming, but I'm wondering. 620 traffic now. Oh, by the way, I should tell you, we're talking to Todd Belt, the professor and director of the political management program at George Washington University, about Elon Musk creating a third party. Text me on the Oakmont Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. Please, no texting and driving. But let me know what you think about that. Would you support an Elon Musk third party? And what would you like to see a third party address? Traffic now, WWL. It is 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking with Professor Todd Belt. He's a professor and director of the political management program at George Washington University, about Elon Musk being a maybe starting a third party. And somebody, a couple of texts that are coming in. Elon needs to go back to tending his own business. He was doing good. Other than that, time to leave the government issues to the people that have the expertise. I think some people would say maybe it's time for people that don't have the expertise. A third viable party would be great, but as with the other two clubs, it all depends on the candidate. For me, somebody else says, is an Elon Musk third party more about taking some power from Trump or actually winning? I support either. So, Professor Belt, when it comes to baby steps and making inroads, is there any way, and you know, you talk about a path to victory, I'm thinking maybe if he targets one race here, one race there, the majorities are so thin in the Senate or the House, either way, relatively speaking, that maybe if he just picks off a seat here or there, then before you know it, he gets some momentum, he's got something going. And I got to piggyback that question with money. Because it's going to take a lot of money, a lot of money. Thoughts on all of that?
Right. Okay, first, let me start with the money part. Obviously, Elon Musk is the wealthiest man in the world, and he spent $25 million in a Supreme Court race, a state Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, and came up short, and he was a little bit miffed by that, said he was going to exit politics, but that was all before the big beautiful bill was passed.
Wait, let me jump in. For a second there. Was it because he didn't spend enough, or he just had a flawed candidate, or why did he lose?
Yeah, I think it was because the candidate was not great, and Wisconsinites. It was really about overturning an old abortion law, and that, you know, abortion is a pretty popular policy. So I don't think it was going to work there. But in terms of trying to get the party organized, remember I was talking about how many signatures you need to get. If we look at the way Ron DeSantis ran his campaign in Iowa in 2024, he decided to go with a very money-heavy campaign where instead of using volunteers, he was going to be hiring people to, you know, work for the campaign. And there's a difference when you have volunteers versus you have paid people, because the paid people don't have the real fire in the belly. They're not quite as energetic about the candidate and the party and want to do the type of work that it takes and work the hours that it takes to get on the ballot. So you'd have to spend a lot more money than you would initially imagine, because you're not going to get as effective volunteers to work on that. But in terms of trying to pick away a couple seats, it is true you could spoil an election. This is what third parties have generally done in the United States, is take votes away from one of the two major parties. But what usually happens after that is the two parties look and see, okay,
there is a group of voters that are interested in the policies of this third party, whatever they are. Let's make those our part of our party's platform and get those voters back. And usually they have been able to do that. For Republicans, after the Reform Party in 1992 with Ross Perot, they were able to make balancing the budget really part of what they wanted to do, and they were able to recoup some of those voters. So the parties adjust, so it's difficult to build momentum. And the fact that we have two-year election cycles mean you have to string that momentum out for a longer period of time. So it's difficult to
Well, what Americans do Americans embrace the idea of a third party? What do polls show? Is it about specific issues, or do they like it in theory, but not in practice?
In theory, but not in practice, yes. When we, early on in the election, you might remember back in early 2024, a lot of people were interested in a third-party alternative. That's why we had RFK running, and other people were going to try to create a unity ticket where you'd have one Republican and one Democrat. And there was a lot of support in the polls, but when it comes right down to it, when you get down to an election day, the polling for third parties really evaporates because people get worried. They don't want their vote to get canceled out. They don't want to vote for a losing candidate. And we know that in politics, it's this fear and anxiety that's caused by wasting your vote is actually more more influential than the attractiveness of a third party.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time as always. Hope you have a great weekend. I'm going to give you tomorrow off already, just like that. Todd Bell, Professor Director of the Political Management Program at George Washington University. Thursday morning, that means we talk to Mike Strain. We come back, Dr. Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Right now we pause for WWL First News. 6:43, 17 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Thursday morning around these parts. That means it's time to talk to our friend Mike Strain, Dr. Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, and a well-respected veterinarian on the North Shore. How you doing, Mike?
Man, I am doing great. How are you, Tommy?
I'm well. I got to ask you, I heard you do something on a commercial that just surprised the heck out of me, and it was about dogs getting sunburned. Did I hear that right?
Well, they can get sunburned, but the heat stress can really get them quickly, especially right now. You know, if you take a dog and put him in the back of a white pickup truck and you be driving through the field, they can still have heat stress and heat stroke, mm-hmm. and they can get burned from the sun. So especially if they're light-skinned, pale-skinned, you know, with white hair. Mm-hmm. And, of course, oftentimes in the summer, a lot of people will shave their dogs. The long-haired dogs can get shaved, and that can expose them to the sun. And so just be careful with that. But the heat stroke, heat stress is a much bigger problem. Do not leave your animal in the car, you know, ever. Do not just run in and leave the animal, or you, of course, little children either, but leave that dog in the car because they will get hot very, very, very quickly. A lot of dogs, especially indoor dogs, they're not used to the heat at all. And if they are out on the porch, you need to have, you know, cool water, shade, and preferably a fan.
I got a text the other day asking me to ask you, and I presume they're listening now, Mike, about this. You talked about muddy gums or something, or some indication when the dog is hot.
Yeah, muddy.
Tell me about
that. In other words, when you look at the gums, that's a medical term that we use. They will look a little dark. They will look will not look uniform. So you think about muddy looking water, and then you look at the gums, instead of being nice and pink, they will be darker. They will be dark red. And you can obviously tell that you have a problem. It's one of the things that we do in the field. You can rapidly assess a patient, whether it's a dog or a horse or whatever, just looking at the gums. The other thing that we do is called a Blanche test, where we, you know, use your thumb and you press against the gum and see how quickly it refills. Mm. And it should refill like in, you know, a second or 1.5 seconds. You get out there to 3 seconds, you have serious cardiovascular problems.
Like they do with humans, almost with the nails, kind of like I've
absolutely.
Seen that.
Okay. Yeah, same thing. That's so exactly right.
So I know some
thing.
Stuff,
but
Mike.
Now is the time to stay cool.
I know some stuff, don't I?
Yes, you do.
Well,
yes, you do.
Not much, a little bit,
so
but a little bit.
I was headed to Dallas to meet with the EPA today, but my flight has now been canceled, and so yes.
What
so
did you do to make that happen?
Well, I guess I slept too hard, but you know, we had this set up. We're meeting with a team, our corresponding team in Dallas. You know, for the EPA, the Department of Ag and Forestry, we are the, you know, the arm of the EPA dealing with all restricted use chemicals mm-hmm. in the state. And it's through a memorandum of understanding between the Environmental Protection Agency and I, in person of the commissioner. And so if you think about the termite spray, if you think about what's being sprayed for mosquitoes, if you think about any type of herbicide, pesticide, fungicide, anything, we work closely with the EPA. And so, you know, we have regular meetings, and we have the new regional administrator, Scott Mason, there in Dallas. He's a wonderful guy to work with. And so we go there, and we go through all the issues from the waters of the U.S., and we're talking about chemicals, compliance issues, air updates on, you know, on emissions. And, of course, we will be also bringing over discussion about trying to expedite the approval of the baits for the feral swine. That is kind of in limbo, and it went from taking 18 months and a few hundred thousand dollars to 8 years and $8 million, and we got to get that back on track. And so, you know, with all the things that we work on, including one, drone usage and uniformity and labeling, so a good discussion, but the rebook and the flight would get me there after the meeting, so that's not going to work.
No.
So we're going to be doing it virtual today. So
there you go.
We have a setup for that. But you know what? Virtual is 90%, but there in person is 100%. And for our, you know, our federal counterparts and all of the alphabet agencies that we work with, you know, I really believe in those personal relationships, especially when, you know, things go sideways on whatever issue it might be, that personal relationship straighten things out.
What is the problem with the swine thing, with the feral swine? Because I thought this was pretty benign, but it was a great way to eliminate or at least to keep these things from breeding. Tell me about what the EPA's problem is.
Well, the EPA said that the toxicant used, which is sodium nitrite. Now, sodium nitrite, if you had bacon and with your breakfast this morning, you had some sodium nitrite. It's been around since, you know, pre-Roman times, and it's used universally, but they said since you're going to use it in a manner to which would result in toxicity, then you've got to do complete studies like it's a new compound. And I totally disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's probably been more research done and published and known about sodium nitrate than anything else. And LSU developed a system where they would literally wrap this stuff in a capsule of, and I think it's more like pogey bait, and only the feral swine would eat it. So you would take it, actually bury it in the ground, and they would dig it up and eat it, and then it would, you know, would kill the pigs, but not other species. It wouldn't affect bear, or there wouldn't be secondary problems like you would have with other toxicants or warfarin. And we were going along well, and then they told LSU, said, look, it's going to cost you, you know, $600,000-$800,000 in fees to register this, unless you went through the State Department of Agriculture. In that case, it would be no cost. And so we were well on our way to getting this product approved, developed by LSU with 12-plus years of research. And then they came back and said, no, you got to start over again and go through this whole process. And that's one of the things we're going to push, to look, this is ridiculous. We need this product. Those feral swine cost hundreds of millions of dollars in damage. The last call I had last night, 8 o'clock last night, friend called me, said these feral swine have destroyed my fields, and they are overpopulating. Now we estimate we have as many as 750,000 feral swine in the state, and we've got to get a handle on it because they cause hundreds of millions of dollars of damage and carry disease and are a threat. They are a threat, you know, little children, et cetera. I mean, they're dangerous out there, and we've got to do something about them.
So, Mike, when it comes to this stuff, the sodium nitrate or whatever it is, when the pig eats it, it dies. If something eats the pig, there's no danger to whatever eats the pig, is it?
Generally, no, because you won't get enough concentration of the sodium nitrite from eating the pig. And so what we've done with other things is that they've added a dye to the product, and so that if for some reason you would slaughter a wild pig, but you would never eat a wild pig that was sick. You never eat anything that's sick, but you would see a blue discoloration, a blue stain in the flesh. So that's part of that. But what it does is that the pig literally goes to sleep. It's just they just go to sleep is what happens, and they just don't wake up. And so we're careful that there's no secondary kills. And the thing of it is, though, if that pig is up and running, there's no toxic dose in them, and you would not slaughter a pig that you found dead or dying, you know, at all.
Right. I meant more along the lines of like nature, you know, I don't know if you got a pig that drops dead somewhere.
No,
goes
you're
to
not
sleep.
Gonna get that. We're very careful with that. You would not get a secondary dose from consuming the flesh that would be high enough to be lethal, you know, because you're thinking of buzzards, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, and other creatures that are, that would eat, you know, would eat that flesh. So that, no, it would not affect them. And that's one of the big deals in developing these toxicants. We're still hopeful that the USDA will actually continue its research on an anti-fertility vaccine. And as they've been working on that diligently, that could be delivered via a cookie bait. And that's not science fiction. We vaccinate wild animals for rabies with cookies that have little capsules. So when they eat the cookie, that the vaccine actually is freeze-dried. It becomes activated and goes through their tonsils and vaccinates them for rabies. And that was developed by Rome Mario, and it's used in the United States and across the world. We can develop the same thing for pigs. Then, you know, we can distribute. And you can distribute that, you know, using an aircraft or other vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And get, you know, and make them non-fertile, because one female can result in over 300 pigs in 3 years.
That's the approach you're taking with that screw worm, right?
Oh, now screwworms. Yes, now screwworms. Another issue. You saw last night that Secretary Rollins has now suspended the importation of Mexican livestock into the United States. That happened yesterday because the screwworm has again jumped its containment by the Isthmus of Panama. And if you look on the map, that's a small area,
mm-hmm.
and we're very concerned about it moving through Mexico and getting into the United States. And so we are spending dollars. We, you know, we've sent dollars to Mexico to help them to breed more sterile flies, and those sterile flies would then mate with the screwworm flies and stop, you know, the progeny. But it's not enough. And so they are building a $300 million facility in Lower Texas to gear up for screwworm sterile flies in case it continues to march towards the border. We have to get a handle on this. And again, because what you've already seen it impacting beef prices already, but it could be, the damage could be in the hundreds of billions. And the thing about this particular pest, it will attack and make sick and kill normal, healthy animals. That's the big deal about this screwworm. And we are gearing up for battle. We're gonna, you know, our goal is to keep it down there at the Isthmus of Panama, because it's a tiny area, much less trying to defend it across the entire U.S.-Mexican border. And so we are gearing up. There are ways that we can treat our cattle and our livestock, you know, but it's very costly. But if it gets here, it's estimated it could destroy up to 80% of the wild deer population and other native species. And so we've got to do everything it takes to stop this invasive pest from getting here.
Real quick, scale of 1 to 10, where are you worried at on that screwworm thing?
I'm at a 6 right now,
okay.
Tell you the truth.
Right.
I am concerned because it is jumping containment in a narrow area. And if it gets up into Mexico and spreads out and starts, you know, the thing about an invasive species is that it takes over the native species and becomes dominant. And it's very difficult to eliminate. And so the best method to fight this is with the sterile flies, not spraying insecticides.
Thank you,
and
Mike.
Then, so, but yeah, yep.
Got you. We're out
all
of time. Right. So thank you. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you next Thursday. Very valuable information. As always, 6:54, 6 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. It is currently 7:14. Aaron Ashberg joins us now, assistant professor of urban peri-urban entomology at LSU, to talk about another bug that's kind of made its way here that's not a lot of fun, stinging Asian needle ants. How you doing, professor?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Everybody's got a story, and I want to hear yours. Tell me how, as a kid, were you, like, fascinated with insects, and that's what led you to where you are? I'm just curious about this.
That's exactly right. I was one of those bug kids running around collecting insects of all kinds. And not only that, I did reptiles and amphibians and birds, dinosaurs, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, Lord, thank goodness you weren't my kid. Thank goodness. Your parents let you have all that in the house or not?
What was that?
Your parents let you have all that in the house?
Well, not all of it, but they would indulge me from time to time.
Hmm. I would have to draw the line at snakes. Let's talk about these. What is it, a stinging Asian needle ant? How big are these? Where'd they come from? How much of a threat are they?
Yeah, so the Asian needle ant, it's a medium-sized ant. I would say probably about the large size of the fire ants would probably be equivalent to what the Asian needle ant looks like. Now, remember, mm-hmm. those fire ants, they have multiple sizes that they can be in. This ant is from Asia, China, Japan, that area. It typically lives in forested areas, and that is also where we found it here in Louisiana. Now, this ant has a similar impact on the environment as our other invasive ant species. It has the potential to impact native fauna through outcompeting other native ants. Mm-hmm. And our native ants, they help support our native ecosystem. The other side effect or potential danger of this ant, I would say, is, of course, these medical aspects that we're seeing and hearing about with this ant. Now, as you already alluded to, it is capable of stinging. Mm-hmm. Now, it is not an aggressive ant. It's not like a fire ant. It won't come after you. However, there is that potential, if you are hypersensitive, to be stung and for that ant to induce anaphylaxis if you are sensitive. And so there is that risk associated with this ant.
So where did they come from again? How did they get here?
Yes, yeah, so they came from China or Japan. They are an Asian native ant. I don't particularly know how they got here. We did start to find them, I believe, in the 1930s in Georgia. So they have been here for some time. Now, within Louisiana, we had not had any reports of the ant. And so we actually started to get some inquiries. People were asking if it was here. And so actually we looked on a citizen scientist website called iNaturalist. Mm-hmm. We actually had two reports by some citizen scientists, Sean Golden and Mike Tybin. They were actually really critical in us finding this ant in the state. Essentially, we went and ground truthed their sightings. We collected the ant. We brought it back to the lab and identified it and confirmed that it was, in fact, the Asian needle ant.
Would we recognize these? Do they build an ant hill bigger than any other? Or, I mean, how would we know if we see them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is a different ant in that sense. It does not create mounds in the traditional sense. They typically live in close association with termites. They are where well, I
you
found
know,
them
it,
was
you
in
see,
wet
you
wood.
See that, Aaron? It's all about who you hang out with. That tells you everything you
that's
need
right.
to know, don't you think?
That's right.
Right there. Okay,
and
go
of course,
ahead.
So, you know, with the termites, you know, hopefully they will consume some Formosan subterranean termites for us. However, you know, they live in that wet wood. That's what they're feeding upon, as well as other insects. So you would typically encounter them if you're digging in the soil or you're working with wet wood. They're kind of more on the outskirts of environments. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that they can't invade our territory and potentially cause health effects if they sting us.
Got to tell you, Aaron, you got everybody's attention when you said eat Formosan termites, do they?
Well, they are a termite specialist. They do prefer to eat termites. I don't know what the impact will be on our Formosan subterranean termites. I'm sure they're here to stay, but if they can reduce some of those numbers, I'm sure everybody would be happy.
See, I know that one thing that I can remember when I first learned about this in grammar school about ecosystems, maybe seventh grade, and how delicate they are and how just a little bit of this can mess up a lot of that. But, man, if these things could eat termites, I guess that would be good, but then you might have to find something to eat the stinging Asian needle ant.
That's correct, and at this time, we don't have any predators for the Asian needle ant. Maybe other invasive ants might suppress their populations. That could be why we hadn't found them in Louisiana until recently. But, you know, given that potential, I don't think they would completely eliminate termites. However, like I said, there could be some exclusion effects where the ants come in, the Asian needle ants come in and take over an environment. Maybe there would be less termites in that area, maybe less of our other invasive ants as well if they're able to establish a foothold. Now, they don't build as big of colonies mm-hmm. as, say, fire ants, so that would be a disadvantage to them compared to some of our other invasive ants that we have.
I want to talk about ants some more when we come back. I know you mentioned a medium ant. My aunt Maureen was a medium ant. My aunt Florence was just a big, giant ant. 720 traffic now, WWO. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Aaron Ashbrook, our friend, assistant professor of urban peri-urban entomology at LSU, talking about the invasive stinging Asian needle ant that has been spotted in the state. And you can always download the Odyssey app if you want to go back and listen to anything we had to say. Let me get this in here real quick if I can, Aaron. We believe in the power of being everywhere. Listen to WWL anytime, anywhere. You get the WWL shows you love. Dave Cohen, me, Newell, Scoot, Sports Talk, and all the local content you crave on the Odyssey, iHeart, and TuneIn apps. You can go back and listen. So tell me, where did these things come from, these ants? Do we know where they came from? And while we're at it, tell me about the Formosan termites, because I guess they came ultimately from Formosa, but how did they get here?
Yeah, so they're actually probably from similar regions of Asia. So the Asian needle ant, it's been found in China, been found in Japan. Of course, I do believe it was in the Taiwan region, which, of course, that's where the Formosan subterranean termite came from as well. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll guess that we acquired the Asian needle ants through trade. That is how we get most of our invasive species. Now, the Formosan subterranean termite, we actually got that invasive termite after World War II. It was pretty well documented that when some of the ships came back from the Pacific, those life rafts were infested with the termites. Okay. And so those wooden rescue boats had them inside already. And once we got those boats off onto the mainland, they were able to quickly establish and spread from there.
So once an invasive species gets here, and again, I'm getting all excited about maybe these Asian ants would eat termites, but we don't know that yet, right?
Well, I know for sure that they do eat termites. However, I guess what I would say is we don't know what the impact would be on our termite populations in the region. However, I would not be too hopeful about it. I don't think they will impact their populations as much as they would hope.
So once an invasive species does get here, is it here to stay? And that's going to lead me into the next question. And I don't know if you talk about this or not, but these screw worms that we're just talking to Mike Strain about, that, you know, now they're starting to affect Mexican beef and so forth and jump in containment. And Mike said he was at about a 6 on a scale of worry between 1 and 10. Talk about, if you will, once an invasive species gets here, how hard is it to get rid of it? And I guess you look at the termites and the answer would be not easy, right?
Yes, that is correct. So there are several different factors that are involved in the establishment and the invasion of an invasive species. So kind of what you're alluding to, just because that organism gets here doesn't necessarily mean it will establish. You know, it has to have a viable food, an environment that is suitable for it. Typically with our invasive species, they escape a predator or an organism that typically preys upon it. So if there isn't another organism that will consume that invasive species in the area, that will also help it establish in an area. And of course, it has to be able to reproduce and spread to new locations. And that's ultimately what we would say is an established invasive species. If we're finding new colonies or new populations in different locations than the initial invasion point.
So when it comes to the screw worm, and I don't know if you're prepared to talk about this, and I didn't invite you on to talk about this, how concerned are you about this thing?
Well, it has been pretty impactful for the cattle industry in the past. It does do extensive damage to the cow as well as to the hide, the leather. We had some major programs in the U.S. historically to make sure that we eliminated it from our country, you know, essentially to keep it out because of its impacts. And so, you know, if Mike Strain is saying that he is concerned about it, I would also be concerned about it as well. He probably has some more information about the potential spillover that is occurring than I do. Mm-hmm. However, yes, I would definitely be concerned about it and its potential impacts that
Always something in it. Aaron, do you ever talk with the Department of Defense, or is that part of any like, because it would seem like one way a country could attack another is to put an invasive species of insects that could cause them a whole lot of problems. Is that part of some of what you do or not?
I don't necessarily do that type of work. There has been, of course, like you alluded to, people have looked at in the past, you know, using insects as biological war agents. Mm-hmm. The DOD is very supportive of pest management and, you know, mosquitoes, ticks, bed bugs, other blood-feeding organisms. They do support research to manage those organisms so that we can better protect military members across the, you know, whether they're overseas or in the U.S., as well as citizens. So they do like applicable research that affects these disease vectoring organisms and help improve the operations of military individuals as well.
Thank you, Aaron. I appreciate your time, as always. Aaron Ashbrook, Assistant Professor of Urban Peri-Urban Entomology at LSU. If I were in charge, I would release butterflies just to spread happiness and joy, because that's the way I am. Time now, WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Phil Napoli, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media in the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. How you doing, Phil?
I'm doing good, thanks.
So I heard about Linda Yaccarino, is that how you say it, stepping down after leading X, and I thought about, immediately my thought was, would I want to work for Elon Musk? And the answer was no, absolutely not. But with that being said, tell me what's going on with, and you have to go slow here because I understand about half of what's going on here, other than the fact that, you know, Holocaust denial and proliferation of Nazi stuff is not good. That I understand. But tell me what's going on with this Grok and Elon Musk. And I don't get all of this. Take us through it, please.
Sure. X has an AI chatbot that Elon Musk's AI company has created, and its name is Grok. Mm-hmm. And it posts on X, and you can, you know, engage with it on X. And apparently a week or so back, Elon Musk felt that Grok was too woke, that some of its responses to queries and such reflected the left-leaning biases of the mainstream media, so he promised to fix it. And apparently that fix has meant that Grok is a big fan of Hitler and the Holocaust, and called itself Mecha Hitler in one post. But now, of course, Grok has been temporarily shut down to be retooled again. So, in short, the chatbot is spewing a lot of anti-Semitic stuff in the wake of it being retooled to be less woke.
So I just called it up on Twitter, and it says, on X, whatever it is, Grok says, we are aware of recent posts made by Grok and are actively working to remove the inappropriate posts. Since being made aware of the content, XA1, who is that? Who's XAI? Oh, artificial intelligence, XAI, I get it, okay. Has taken action to ban hate speech before Grok post on X. XAI is training only truth-seeking. And thanks to the millions of users on X, we are able to quickly identify and update the model where training could be improved. So what the hell does that mean? Who is Grok saying we are aware? Who is the we behind Grok?
It's XAI. So they, yeah, this is their, you know, and you know,
wait, is that people?
Is for?
I feel like I'm talking about Soylent Green.
Nobody is, you know, this is an autonomous, you know, AI chatbot. So mm-hmm. It is given, you know, but you know, it can be, you know, retooled where it can, you know, the instructions that guide it can be changed. And so whatever the instructions were a week or so back to instruct it to try to be less politically correct, this is the outcome. So it's sort of, you know, back to the drawing board, back to the lab with Grok. And presumably it will reappear, and presumably it will behave a bit differently than it has over the past week or so.
All right, so let me phrase it a different way. Why would I want to get involved with Grok? What would I use it for?
You have ask the million-dollar question. You have the same question I have. What is the point? Why do
that's,
any of
that's
us
it.
To engage?
Phil, that you nailed it. What is the point of all? That's what I'm trying to get at. What is the point?
I think the point is to try to. If, again, I'm speculating here because I think there is no point. Personally, to try to showcase, you know, what AI can do. You know, and this is the thing is, you know, within the, you know, the high profile examples of AI are in these sort of generative AI spaces where people can chat and engage with AI bots, and feel like they are engaging with a human being. And somehow we're supposed to be impressed by this. And perhaps this is, you know, something that will spur further investment, but no, I think, you know, there are lots of valuable things AI could do. Perhaps it could have done a better job of predicting flooding patterns, for example. Mm-hmm. But you know, but this sort of thing, I see no point.
Because I saw a thing on TV. We got to take a break here. We can pick it up. We come back. Some network had a story about a guy that was opting for a relationship with AI or a chatbot rather than a real person because. Apparently was telling him what he wanted to hear. Some, and again, my question is, what is the point in this? I don't understand. Why would you not just talk into a mirror and tell yourself what you want to hear? Maybe I'm looking at it differently. But we'll talk about how AI chatbots work in general. Phil Napoli is our guest, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media in the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. And of course, what is concerning about this is that if people go to a chatbot for information and they get misinformation, well, then they think it's genuine and then they pass it along. And Lord knows we've had enough of that already. 750 traffic now, WWL. 756, 4 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Phil Napoli, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media in the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age, rather. Elon Musk's Grok AI started having some problems praising Hitler. Microsoft tried to do this back in 2016, I think it was. They launched a Tay artificial intelligence chatbot, and people apparently gamed it into praising Hitler. And again, it goes to what's the point in this, Phil, that you said earlier. I don't understand. So people, and then I saw a thing on television, a network story about a guy that opted for chatbot as opposed to a human relationship. I don't, this is just a computer talking back to you based on what people program it to say, reacting to what it is that you put into it.
Yeah. And that's the important thing to remember, the nuts and bolts of how these work. They are, you know, there's this massive amount of data. So you figure something like Grok is at the very minimum loaded with every post on Twitter and X in its history. Mm-hmm. And all it's doing is trying to predict. The way these AI systems work is to predict what words should come next. Mm-hmm. So any notion that there's, you know, profound thought happening there that would be, say, valuable to you as you're looking for a friend or seeking relationship advice. Some of these things are.
Yeah, let me jump in for a second. Because if I'm going to say chatbot, Philbot, okay, what's the best way for me to feel better about myself? I mean, that's foolishness, right? What? Tell me about
this. The next question is, well, on what is the chatbot drawing upon to answer your question? And as we know, that's one of the things that these AI companies have been doing, has been just sucking up any kind of content, any kind of data, everything they can get their hands on that becomes the raw material that informs the outputs of the chatbot. You know, it's indiscriminate. We don't know oftentimes what they do and don't have access to. Why we should feel confident in responses generated based on, you know, mathematical equations about what word to choose next from this vast, you know, quantity of text is a bit mind-boggling to me. That
so it's,
would feel
it's just
that
matching.
The right
it's
way to
matching
go.
This with that, right? It's like in the old days when you were a kid, they'd give you match this with that on a test. That's what this is doing, but at like 1,000 miles an hour. Accurate?
Right. It's like, all right, what is the most likely word that should follow this word based on the trove of data we have in our in our database. Oh, this is the most likely word that comes next. So, you know, unfortunately, what this tells us about Grok is that there's been a lot of anti-Semitism on Twitter and X over the years, which we already know is the case. So no one should be surprised at all that this is the way Grok is behaving. It's behaving the way a lot of users on the platform have behaved for years and years.
20 seconds. I want to look something up. Where should I go?
You want to look something up?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even it's frustrating to me. Even good old fashioned Google now shoves AI responses down your throat, whether you ask for it or not. So I don't even know. I'm not satisfied with any of my options right now. I need to do some more digging on that.
I don't think my Uncle George has his Encyclopedia Britannicas anymore. And even if he did, they'd be outdated by now. Thank you, Phil. Appreciate it. We'll talk to Arthur Hardy about Mardi Gras when we come back. WWL. 8:15. Apparently, I'm getting some texts here from people with the satellite radio. They changed the picture that's up there from the one that was of me with a bow tie when I was like, 3,000 pounds. And the difference is now you can actually see my eyes because my fat little cheeks haven't closed all of that up between my cheeks and my forehead. Arthur Hardy joins us now. Either way, I hope it doesn't frighten you.
I'm so glad they did that. I've thought the same thing. That's the very, very old Tommy, or former or fatter, let's call it what it was.
I hope it doesn't startle anybody as they drive. I certainly hope not. Arthur Hardy, founder of the Mardi Gras Guy, joins us now. How you doing, Arthur?
I'm good. Just got back from 2.5 weeks in Norway visiting our grand twins and had a wonderful time. 58 degrees, 20% humidity, and then I step off the plane at Moisant.
And get driven into the ground, right?
Yeah.
Felt like DeMario Davis just sacked you, is what you felt like.
Oh, man. Anyway, it's good to be home, except for the weather.
I was talking to J.P. Moreau yesterday about what's going on with ocean and so forth, and I got to thinking after the conversation was over and throughout the day yesterday, it seems like, and you're a local guy, you can tell me what you think, in the 80s, I don't know if it was the oil bust or what, but it seems like Mardi Gras went crazy with everybody. It expanded too much. Country clubs went crazy because the oil boom was here, and it expanded too much, and there was not enough money to support either. And now it seems like things are starting to contract back to where what is the right size. And I know you can't speak to country clubs, but am I on to something here with Mardi Gras or not? Because ultimately, it's the greatest free show on earth, but it costs a ton of money.
Well, it does, and yet you have crews lining up to take the place if there is one, if a crew goes out of business, and don't write ocean off just yet. Not that you have, but some people have. I have an idea they're going to be back in some fashion. But the point is what JP and this Governmental Affairs Committee did yesterday, and I applaud them for it, to try to have some sort of process in place. If we're going to have a new parade, what kind of criteria will it be held to so it's not a one-off? We're preparing for our 50th anniversary Mardi Gras Guide, and I've been doing a lot of looking back, and this number astonished me. Since 1977, when we started the magazine, if you look at last year's parade schedule, 29 of the parades from last year have been founded in those last 49 years. But in that same period, catch this, 75 parades have gone out of business. Mm-hmm. 75. And that's in Orleans, Jefferson, St. Bernard, St. Tammany. So, parades come and go, but I think JP's quite correct. If and when there's a spot available, let's be darn sure that whoever we give it to is financially viable and is not a one-off.
Well, and he talked about kicking the tires on it. I understand that. We due diligence, call it whatever you want. But how do you go about it? First of all, Arthur, let me take a step back. If I'm going to start a Mardi Gras crew, if I decide I want to have the crew of Tucker, well, Tux is already used. Let's make it something else. Screw Tommy. How do I even go about this? Because the first thing I got to do is I got to have capital. I got to get people to sign up. I don't know what kind of contracts they sign to join the crews. Take me through all of that, because I think we take that for granted when we set up the lawn chairs and we don't realize the business part behind it.
Well, exactly. The first thing you have to do is find out, is there a spot for you to parade? In Orleans, there isn't. So forget that at this point. There's certainly a positions in St. Tammany and Jefferson and St. Bernard. But my first step would be to go to governmental officials and say, hey, if I can put this together, will you allow us to parade? If not, you're wasting your time. But it always starts with capital, and that starts with members. And the question always is, why should I join the crew of Tommy when they're 30 clubs that are looking for members and advertising them on the internet. Why not join a crew that has a 10-year track record? So it's a really tough sell to start a new crew. Then you've got to hire, you know, a contract with float builders. You have to have, in every parish, there's a minimum number of bands you have to have. Competition for them is very great. And where and when are you going to parade? I mean, how many, again, there's all kind of positions available outside of New Orleans. But let's face it, everybody wants to be on St. Charles Avenue. Mm-hmm. So it's, man, it's a tough sell. I could never recommend anybody try to start a club right now. Now, there are some existing organizations that have a ball but not a parade, or their members ride in the crew already. And their thinking is, well, you know, if we pull all these guys out of Crew X, we can start our crew of Tommy. But it's a business. It's a business, and it takes a lot of capital and leadership. You better have been an officer in an existing parade and know the ropes before you try to be a captain of a new club.
Are these set up as LLCs, Arthur? Is there a board that runs these things? How does that action?
Well, by law, they have to be nonprofit organizations. And some are captains, some are boards. You know, that can be done in different ways. You have to register with the state. But frankly, I think we have enough parades. Maybe we have too many. Mm-hmm. Parades ending at 1 in the morning is just not acceptable. It's an embarrassment of riches. It really is.
That's what I'm saying. It seems like less could be more. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, all right? Because I think less could be more. I really do, and that's what I mean by overexpansion. And all right, 820, Arthur Hardy, our guest here. Got any thoughts on Mardi Gras? You can text them in at 504-260-1870. No texting and driving. That's the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Traffic now, WWL. 4.5, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Arthur Hardy, publisher, the founder of the Mardi Gras Guide, who's working on the 50th issue, I guess, as we speak, Arthur? Yes?
You better believe it.
All right, so, you know, we're talking about less being more and parades going until 1 o'clock. How do you fix that? And let me take a step back first, because, you know, I've ridden in a couple of, I was a Grand Marshal of Tux one year, and I was lucky enough to do that, and Ed Muniz hooked me up a couple of times to ride in a parade. But one thing to me, it's all about, and it's, I make another analogy to golf, or another, bring up golf again, it's about who you play with. So when when crews say, you know, you can ride, have the experience of this or that, the other thing, is that as good? Do people value that as much as if they don't know who they're standing next to or riding with or partying with?
No, I don't think so. And that's why people want to start a new club, just you know, us and the guys, and we'll bring some other friends and join up. And that's all, just about all these crews started with a bunch of like-minded people who had something in common, worked together, fraternities played together, you know, same neighborhood. But it's different now. And, of course, with so many opportunities to ride, you have choices. So maybe you don't go solo. Maybe, you know, the co-ed clubs, obviously, you bring your significant other. Or, you know, you don't have to go by yourself. But it's just, I just think it's gotten so big, and we need to maybe pull it back a little bit. And, of course, the way to do that is to try not to have triple-header parades. Mm-hmm. And that was a really good idea this year when Al moved from that first Friday night where we had a triple-header, first Friday night, yeah, that's right, to the spot vacated by Knicks. So that made a doubleheader that night, which is manageable. And that first Friday, instead of having three parades, you had two. So that made sense. But now we're talking about if we lose a parade. I really think the schedule in New Orleans is not going to change for the next couple of years. I think what we have is relatively solid. Now, Oshun has had its problems for several years with finances, with the quality and quantity of the units in the parade, and it's tough. It's expensive business, but I just have a feeling something's going to be worked out to it. They don't lose that permit, because that permit is really precious.
It would seem like consolidation, and I know this is not going to happen because it's social groups, right? But if you could consolidate a couple of these into, what are your thoughts on this? And no disrespect to anybody, but it seems like the more parades you have, the more groups you need, the more bands you need. There are only so many groups, so many bands that go around, which means you wind up with some units that maybe technically fit the bill, but not really add a lot to the parade, if you understand what I'm saying. Again, no disrespect to anybody. But it would seem like you'd do better to consolidate some of these and maybe have a couple of more super crews or something along those lines where you could have synergy and have bigger and better while doing with less, if that makes sense?
It does, but mergers have been tried and have almost never worked.
How come? Because the social part of it?
Yeah, and egos, who's the captain, who's the boss, who sits on the board. One example where it has worked is the Mystic Order of Phoenix, which rides with Sparta. That has worked. But in truth, would the ladies rather ride as their own crew? I bet they would. But there's no permit available. So, you know, there are ways to do this, but it's not easy. And remember, this is also just supposed to be about having fun.
Right.
It's, you know, the old JP mentioned yesterday about, you know, how watching Mardi Gras get organized is like watching making sausages. so many things you don't realize. But there was another significant thing that happened at a meeting yesterday. It's gotten overlooked. Yeah. The alternative parades, the Chewbacca's of the world, Coupe de Vue, you know, Joan of Arc, that are technically not Mardi Gras parades because they're out of the 12-day window leading up to Fat Tuesday. They have different ordinances and all. He's trying to kind of tighten up that permitting process with early deadlines that will allow the public and these crews and businesses along the routes to know early on what the parade routes are. These groups have had routes changed 48 hours before the parade the last few years, and that's because the NOPD is not charged with policing those groups. Off-duty police officers can sign up to be a part of the safety patrol for those units. So it depends on how many people line up, how long the route can be. Well, that's fine, but let's know it 2 months out, not 2 days out. So that's going to be tightened up, and that's going to give these crews a lot more stability and flexibility to understand, here's where we're going, guys. I've known businesses that bought, you know, 28 extra cases of Budweiser and then found out the parade's not going there. And that's not fair.
And then they had to invite you over, and you took care of that. Listen, me too, Arthur. Outside of the 12 days that you're talking about, has there been an expansion of groups that are parading or not really?
Yes, indeed.
No,
I don't think so. This is the artsy part of Mardi Gras, and you don't have to have a lot of money to join, but it's
the true organic part almost.
It is, and it's diversity at its best, and I think they complement the quote-unquote real parades. They don't compete with them, and they're drawing big audience. I mean, Chewbacca's hit, I think, 2,000 people on foot in about a four-hour parade this year. So God bless them, you know.
Thank you, Arthur. Good luck with the humidity. You'll adjust eventually.
I will. Thank you, buddy.
Or die. Arthur Hardy, founder of the Mardi Gras Guide. We'll talk to Joe Ogeron about men hating when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. It is currently 8:46, 14 till 9. I love talking to smart people. I really do, because I always learn something. And one of those joins us now who happens to be a representative. That's not what makes him smart. No disrespect. What makes him smart is he's a physicist. How you doing, Joe Ogeron?
I'm doing fine, Tommy. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time. Do you think if you devoted every second of your life for the next 20 years, you could teach me physics?
Absolutely. I think we could. You don't think so?
That's a fool's errand. Believe me, you'd never make any headway at all. Let's talk about what's going on with the men. And I just like to bring that up because you are a scientist and you know what you're talking about. And I think it's great when people that are educated, and we need lawyers in the legislature. We need, you know, doctors, and we need other things. We also need scientists in the legislature to keep an eye on what's going on and do things for the right reasons. Tell me what's going on with the menhaden industry and a new study that's out. Well, first of all, Joe, take a step back. Yeah. A lot of people don't know what menhaden is or what the menhaden industry is, so maybe you can start there for context.
All right. Well, menhaden is a small one of the most important fish in the Gulf because even though it's nothing that's edible by humans, it's a small, bony and oily fish. It still can be caught in massive numbers and provide lots of protein, and most of your omega-3 oil that goes into your fish oil peels actually comes from menhaden.
How big are these things, Joe?
They're only about 5 or 6 inches long. They're
you would never eat
bony.
This on a plate or anything like that, right?
Never.
They
never,
always process
never,
them.
Never.
Okay.
Always process. And it's a very important. It's the U.S.'s second largest fishery, and here in the Gulf, it's one of Louisiana's largest fisheries. The amount of weight of menhaden, or also the common name is pogies, mm-hmm. the amount of weight that they catch in a year, there's primarily two companies that do this, and the amount of weight basically equals everything else Louisiana catches. Every oyster meat, every shrimp, crawfish, turtle, crab meat, redfish, snapper, you add everything else up that comes out of Louisiana's waters, and you put it side by side with the amount of menhaden that they catch, or pogies, and they're about equal. So that's how much we catch.
And I want to get that out there, because I know a guy that's a maritime attorney, and up until 10 years ago, I had no idea what a menhaden was. And since then, I've been blown away with how important they are and what a big part of the catch in the Gulf they are. But they can also be controversial, and also they are different regulations, I think, for the way they fish in the Gulf with different states, right? Take me through that.
Well, Louisiana probably has the most lax regulations. I mean, they're probably thinking that they're overregulated, but the point is that they fish in Louisiana because they can't fish in Florida. They have a quota limit, and it's almost in Texas that's probably not enough for them to spend the money going over there and fishing unless the menhaden move there and they go for a short time just to fill up that small quota that Texas allows, and everywhere else, even the only other place where it's done is on the East Coast is Chesapeake Bay area in Virginia, mm-hmm. and there they have large, you know, more stringent restrictions. Louisiana is kind of like, I'm going to call it the last Wild West for industrial reduction menhaden, and let me parse those words. Industrial is that they use basically large OSV, the same kind of boats that we use in the oil and gas industry to move equipment to the oil rigs. Usually those vessels, whenever they're done with their service, they're bought up by these menhaden companies and converted so that all the tanks that used to bring out water or drilling muds and stuff are now storage tanks for the menhaden, and pumping systems and netting systems and things like that. So
let me take a quick break right here, Joe, because I think we reached a good stopping point. I got to get traffic in. Okay. Then when we come back, we can talk about, because they do cast a wide net, not metaphorically, but literally. They catch a lot of stuff in it, and we'll talk about redfish and other species and what kind of effect they have on it when we come back. Representative Joe Ogeron, our guest, our friend, he's a physicist. More when we return. Traffic now, WWL. 56 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Representative Joe Ogeron, a physicist, a scientist. We've already established what the menhaden or pogey industry is. They do have these big boats that cast wide nets. They catch a lot. They get a lot of stuff in there that they, besides pogey or menhaden. Joe, what does the study show about the bycatch, the things that get caught in there that become entangled, that get killed and wasted, and what happens from here?
Okay, well, one of the biggest surprises was that a lot of the user conflict were from recreational fishermen that fish alongside right off the beach where these industrial menhaden fisheries like to fish where the fish are, of course, mm-hmm. and they use spotter planes to find them and basically cast the net around there. And the user conflict with the recreational fishermen is whenever they're done, there's usually dead redfish floating out on the water. Mm-hmm. And the biggest surprise was that they were thinking that as they encircle the menhaden and whatever else is making the menhaden school, let's say in this case redfish, jack crevalles, sharks, whatever else it is, they all get encased in this netting. And they squeeze the net to a small area and suck out the menhaden, what's left in the net is one of the three types of bycatch. That's called the rollover bycatch, whatever's left. And they was believed that that was where the redfish were dying, but this report shows that the vast majority of those in the net or that are remain in the net after they suck out the vast majority of the menhaden survive. The other side of that coin is there are some redfish and other species that get sucked up in the holes with the menhaden, generally the smaller sized redfish and other species. And those that pass through the, let's call it the pumping process of getting brought on board. And even though once it's on board, there's like a bars, grade bars that the menhaden and very small bycatch fish fall through. But the larger fish, like the redfish and sharks, they get sucked up in the hose. Those, unfortunately, the other side of the coin is those have a horrible survival rate. Like only 5% of them.
So, Joe,
the vast majority of them die.
Before we run out of time as a scientist, what do you do with this data? What do you do next?
All right. So the main thing I wanted to know from this data was, how close to the beach.
That's
been always the user conflict. Is
Joe, there's no way we're going to get this in before the news. That's important, though. I want to ask you to hang on, okay? And I'll wrap this up after the news, and we'll talk about dogs. Can you hang on a minute?
Sure.
All right. I'm sorry. I didn't realize it was running as late as we were, but I think it is important. So we'll talk about where we go from here with menhaden, and then we'll talk about what puppies think with a guy that runs a college at Duke University about puppies. I quickly back to Joe Ogeron, state representative, physicist, and then, Joe, you might want to listen to this. I don't know if you have a dog or not, but we're going to talk to Vanessa Woods, director of the puppy kindergarten at Duke University, about what our dogs are thinking. Do you have a dog or not?
I do not, but I have two grand pups. So, I'm waiting to convert those to grandchildren. But good.
You'd be surprised with this latest to be able to teach you, because I read the book and it's amazing. Let's get back to menhaden real quick. So as a physicist, you got this information, and what do you do? I know the whole idea was to keep them farther away from the shore, right? Is that going to happen, or what happens from here?
I think from the distance from the shore, we're pretty much at a status quo. 3 years ago, I had put in a bill to keep them a half mile off. It failed. But then they had subsequent issues where they put dead pogies all over the beach and redfish. And the Wildlife and Fisheries Commission actually subsequently started enforcing that same half-mile buffer with a little bit larger distances in places like Grand Isle and Port Fouchon. So I think distance to the shore, we're at a status quo right now. What the bycatch study really showed was that the ones that get sucked into the hose, even though it has a cage to allow the menhaden in and try to stop the larger species of bycatch, they're going to adjust the geometry. I got word from both of the companies that do this that they're going to immediately start working on a better geometry to be able to allow them to suck up the menhaden and leave more of the bycatch, redfish, and other things in the net where their survivability is good. So that's the immediate actions.
Outstanding. Thank you, Joe. You can come back whenever you want and keep listening about these puppies. I'm serious. With that, we welcome in Vanessa Woods, you bet, director of the puppy kindergarten at Duke University. Good morning, Vanessa. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? Thanks for having me on the show.
Is it Dr. Woods?
No, just Vanessa is fine.
Because I read the book. And it was a fascinating book, Puppy Kindergarten. What was the name of the book? Puppy Kindergarten, I think was the name of it. I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah,
right now.
Puppy Kindergarten.
And it's a fascinating book. And I'm going to open the phone lines here, 504-260-1870, the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Text your questions in if you have questions about what your puppies are thinking or what the dogs are thinking when they're doing this or doing that. Because this lady, again, runs puppy kindergarten and they study dogs at Duke University. The book is a fascinating read, and you can get it, I guess, at all the usual outlets, Puppy Kindergarten?
Yeah, that's right. Everywhere books are sold.
All right, so let me start really with a couple of observations, I guess, from the book, if I may. One thing that surprised me, and I was telling somebody this, a chef at a restaurant last night, I hope he's listening, that he needed to listen to this part of it, because you think it's by breeds, but it's not necessarily by breeds. Some dogs might be great at sniffing out bombs. Other dogs might be great at being companion animals, and it could be the same breed, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's what we found is that, people have a lot of ideas about breeds. They like to judge, dogs by their covers. But, we work with military working dogs and we work with assistance dogs. And those dogs are as different as two different species, really. But if you're looking at them, they're all Labrador retrievers and you can't tell them apart from a photo. So, it's a lot like people in that, it's not so much what they look like, but really how they've been sort of like bred and raised and trained.
So why Labrador retrievers? For example, I have, and I worked from home today because I have And I got to run this story by you, too. It started as Oscar, who was a rescue. Then it went to Teddy. I didn't like that. I'm a Sanford and Son fan, so I named him Grady. But then Vanessa, I changed it to G-R-R-R-A-D-Y. You get it? Grady.
So, Grady.
You like
yes.
that? Grady.
Yes.
So how hard is it? How hard is it to change a dog's name?
No, not hard at all. I mean, dogs respond to all sorts of things, and they're really good at recognizing their names, and they're just like kids in that, you know, if you want to call them like a whole different bunch of things. Our dog is called Neutron. He also goes by Nucci, and, you know, Neutron Bomb, and, you know, wow. Hey You, and Stop What You're Doing. So,
I came home from work yesterday, and
dogs are very capable of understanding when you're referring to them and sort of like different terms of endearments that we use.
Yeah, I came from home from work yesterday, and he had torn a lot of stuff up, so I called him some different things, none of which were his name, but I did call him some different things. Let's talk about...
He probably understood you were still referring to him.
Let me tell you about, and that's why I wanted to talk about this dog. This dog is a rescue, but I had a boxer before, Betsy the Boxer, and I talked about her on the air, and I love this dog like you wouldn't believe. And I don't know that I'll ever love this dog like I did Betsy, but this dog seems more emotionally attuned with me. And after having read the book, this dog seems to sense when I, and it's just a mutt. I have no idea what it's made of, what it you know, is in it or whatever. But it seems to sense my moods. In your research, do you notice that some dogs are better at sensing moods for people than others? Some dogs are more protective than others, and do you have any idea where that behavior comes from?
Oh, no, absolutely. Like, there are dogs that are super attentive to you. You know, they make a lot of eye contact. They pay attention to whatever you're doing. They like to be with you. So, I mean, really, dogs are just like people. There's this really sort of, like, variable thing. There's other dogs who are, like, really independent. You know, they don't really mind if you're gone for a long time. And so there's just, like, different personalities of different dogs, and we find that it really has nothing to do with breed. I think that, you know, as you're saying, that some people have the dog who's like the love of their life, and it may be like, you know, a boxer or a poodle. And so what they're trying to do, I think, by using breed, is they're trying to predict what their dog is going to be like by, you know, just if I get a boxer, it's going to be the same as my other boxer. But we really found that that's not the case. And something that, you know, is really predictive is something like service dog organizations or military working dogs or any kind of working dogs, is that they breed for a certain temperament and a certain sort of like cognitive style. And that's what's really predictive of who a dog is going to grow up to be.
So let me tell you about this dog, and you can tell me if I'm making stuff up in my head or not, because, Vanessa, I do make stuff up in my head, believe me. but I've already noticed that with this dog, my behavior does not change. I notice this dog react to me if I get upset in my head and I don't do anything physically different, nothing at all. And it just baffles me, is how would this dog know to come to me and attempt to comfort me if I'm having a tough time, even though my behavior has not changed? Am I making stuff up in my head, or has your research found that dogs are capable of that?
Well, I mean, we've just been really astounded with how much dogs are capable of. And if you think about it, I mean, there are dogs who can sniff, you know, who can detect when someone's about to have a seizure. Mm-hmm. Dogs who can detect, you know, if someone's blood sugar is low with absolutely no behavioral change. And it's like, it's, you know, it's almost magical. It's like, how do they do that?
It is, because I'm telling you, in this case, I've done like purposely not changed my behavior at all and made sure I didn't move, didn't do anything different at all. But yet the dog seems to know. How?
Well, it's that if you, like, just like seizures and just like, you know, if you're having low blood sugar, really strong emotions like anger, there's also, like, physiological changes that happen with that, right? You have, like, an accelerated heart rate, mm-hmm. your cortisol goes up, and, you know, that's something that dogs is definitely within the realm of something that dogs can respond to. And it's not that all dogs are going to be able to respond to that, but there are a few gifted dogs who, without any training or without any kind of, you know, schooling, can like detect that and respond to that in a certain way. And that's how, you know, certain sort of like service dog organizations got onto the whole diabetes dogs and seizure alert dogs, is because they noticed that dogs were responding before either the seizure happened or before the blood sugar dropped to a certain level. And so absolutely, like, it's within the realm of possibility that your dog could, you know, detect when you become agitated. Yeah, sure, because they're responding to these physiological sort of, like, symptoms that you or I can't detect.
So this dog could make a great service. I don't know if he's a Labrador or not. It looks like he's got some Labrador in him, but he could make, it seemed as though he would make a good service dog. Yes or no?
Yeah, I mean, so it's not actually the breed. It's not that, you know, any kind of dog could
make
a service dog.
Again, it's a mutt. I have no idea what kind of dog it is, but go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's all sorts of dogs that have become trained to be service dogs, to be trained in sort of like, you know, performing tasks that people who have disabilities can perform, because that's, you know, the definition of a service dog. Could your dog be that service dog? Absolutely. But the thing is that usually service dogs are Labrador retrievers, because people with disabilities have enough barrier to access. And that's what kind of the public sort of seems to think of as a service dog. They have, like, this Labrador retriever in mind. So if you have, like, a Chihuahua who's supposed to be a service dog, then, you know, you might have barriers from the other side of the leash. But can your dog respond to you and comfort you and, you know, help you do tasks that you may not otherwise be able to do? Then absolutely.
Yeah, but yet he, you know, with all of those skills, he made the mistake of eating another dog's, you know what, now that's all I think of. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Vanessa Woods is our guest. She and her husband run the puppy kindergarten at Duke University. We've spoken to her husband before. I'm getting the questions here rolling in the text line, 504-260-1870, about what our dogs are thinking, about training dogs, best way to train a puppy, teach an old dog new tricks, all of this. A lot of dogs are very popular. A lot of people have them. Cats, on the other hand, they kind of do their own thing. So 504-260-1870, we will come to you. Somebody said, Tommy, your dog is coming to you because he hears you crying and he wants to lick the tears off your face because they're salty, just joking. No, but I'm saying I had absolutely no movement, no nothing, but yet the dog knew that something was running through my mind, which is crazy. 921 back in a flash, WWL. 927. I was saying yesterday, you know, what we do here really in the morning is more like a podcast than a traditional talk show, because we like to give you some different information on different things and just discuss some things of interest. And one of those is the way dogs think. And we're talking with Vanessa Woods, director of the Puppy Kindergarten at Duke University, and about the book that I read, Puppy Kindergarten. And somebody texted in, there's a true story here, and I'm honest on the air, Vanessa, okay? This is a true story.
Okay.
Somebody texted in, and I did not move, okay? Somebody texted in, okay. I just read this in my head, and it said, please try to let your guests talk without constantly cutting them off. Have no idea about the puppy book content because you did not let the lady talk about it. Now, as I read that, first of all, I apologize for doing that. I get excited sometimes, and I can't see you, so I don't know when you stop talking. Sometimes I interrupt people. I have a bad habit. I try to stop it. But as I read that, listen to me. As I read that, Grady came over and put his head on my foot. I'm not kidding you. Now, isn't that amazing? Because that can, you know, it kind of hurt my feelings a little bit, but it's right. It's accurate. I'll admit that. Nobody's perfect. But isn't that amazing that a dog would come and put his head on my foot just for me reading that to myself in my head?
I'm so glad Grady is there for you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, say it right. It's Grady.
Grady.
Somebody, he named himself. Somebody wants to know about leaving the TV on when you leave a dog alone. Does that help or not, or does it aggravate them?
I think it really depends on the dog. I think most owners will know if you leave the TV on. Some dogs, like we've had puppies through kindergarten who are fascinated with television and they will just watch TV all day. And then some of them just don't have the attention for it and it doesn't really sort of like phase them one way or the other. So I think it depends on your dog. I mean, I think it can help. But yeah, I think that's really up to the owners.
I think if the dog likes a lot of what's on TV today, it can't be very smart. With that being said, let me shut up and let you tell me about the puppy book, and I'm not going to interrupt you for this person to text it in.
Okay, all right. So the Puppy Kindergarten is about the Puppy Kindergarten at Duke University. We raised we had about 101 puppies through the program, so we are very familiar with all the puppy things. But the main purpose of Puppy Kindergarten was to try and figure out how puppy brains developed, because there was no real sort of like research on a large scale about that. And so, you know, puppies have these, dogs have these extraordinary abilities, as you've experienced with Grady. And we kind of wanted to figure out like when they came online, how they developed, and was there a way that you could raise them that would sort of like influence whether or not, you know, they would grow up to be successful service dogs.
Are you done?
That's it. I'm done. You can talk now.
Yeah. All right. I just want to make sure. I don't want to get anybody mad. One thing that did amaze me in a book is how, and I've done this with this dog as well, how a dog can pick up on your pointing to the point of, now this dog, I'll hit the ball with a tennis racket, and sometimes it goes over the fence. So I'll go out through the garage, and he'll come with me and run around to the other side of the fence, pick up the ball, and bring it back. And it amazes me the thought process that goes on that the dog can put all that together. So how does the a canine brain somehow reason that, okay, Tommy hit the ball over the fence. Now I got to go get it so we can continue to play ball. So he's going to open the garage door. I'm going to run and get the ball behind the fence and bring it back in so we can play. How in the world does the dog process all of that?
Well, I'm really glad you appreciate that because, you know, this is just one of the funny things about, you know, science is that everybody's dog, like all dog owners are like, yeah, of course, you know, if I point to where something is hidden or if I try to help my dog by giving them a cue, of course they'll be able to understand it. But I mean, science was really behind the time a couple of decades ago where, you know, even our closest relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos, could not sort of follow these helpful gestures that we were using to help them. And it is complicated because, you know, the ball goes over the fence and Grady is sort of like looking to you for help and you open the garage door and Grady is like, oh, you know, obviously I have to go out and get it. Then that's kind of like, well, Grady has to think, well, I know that you know that I don't know something and that you are now going to help me in order so that we can, you know, continue playing together. And, you know, it's skills like these that are really predictive of whether or not a service dog is going to make it. Because, you know, there's just millions of people in America with disabilities, millions of people who could use a service dog, but there's a really short supply. And one of the problems is that it takes 2 years and about $50,000 to raise each dog, and then half of them don't make it. So the whole purpose of puppy kindergarten was to see if we could come up with these sort of like early aptitude testing so that we could run a puppy of like, you know, 10 or 12 weeks through this series of cognitive games and then predict at that young age whether or not they were more likely to make it as a service dog.
Tell me about this in the audience, some of those cognitive games, because I found those fascinating as well.
Yeah, so like one of the ones is just as you talked about, like we'll hide food under cups, and it's kind of, they're all based on games that you play with children. So children usually before they can talk. So one of them is, you know, you hide food or something they want under one of two cups, and then you point to them to help them find it. You give them sort of like clues and gestures. Other games are sort of like more like the impossible task. And if anyone's interested, we have also a Netflix special called Inside the Mind of a Dog, where you can really see this play out, is where, you know, you have a game that you play that the dog can solve. Like you put a treat in a container and they can get the lid off, but then all of a sudden you lock the container, and so then it becomes this impossible task. And the question is, what does your dog do? And some dogs will, like, you know, just go at the container. They're like, I just got it before, I can totally get this out, I can do this, you know, I'm gonna solve this. And then other dogs will just sit and look at you and make them a lot of eye contact, and, you know, come on, you just put this in here, I know you've got opposable thumbs, get it out for me, like, we're gonna solve this together, this is something that we're doing together. And, you know, it's interesting because the way that dogs solve these problems can predict what career they're going to take. So, for example, like you want military working dogs, like you want the bomb sniffing dogs. They're the ones who usually like just go at the container and like they'll just like they are going to solve this on their own. And it makes sense because they're usually the ones who have to run towards danger when everybody else is running away. But if for service dogs, someone who needs to help people, open wheelchairs, turn on lights, do laundry, that kind of thing, they're the ones that make a lot of eye contact and, you know, really try and, you know, solve the problem together. So that's just an example of one of the games that we play. And the fact that there's no kind of like smart or dumb dog or wrong or right answer. What we're interested in is finding out how dogs solve problems when they're really young and then what they can predict about who they'll be when they get older.
That was what interested me so much, Vanessa, was that people tend to think it's a smart dog or a dumb dog, but it's as though, to me, it's the same, and I'm going to make probably a terrible analogy here, but, you know, some people are math and physicists. The gentleman we were talking to before you came on was a physicist. He could try to teach me physics from now until the cows came home, and he'd have no success. I'm more of a wordsmith, of a legal kind of linear thinking kind of guy. Is that the same thing when it comes to dogs, that some dogs are wired differently than others? Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. There are some dogs who are going to be really – well, what we call physics is how they understand the physical world. Like, how mm-hmm. do they understand gravity? How do they understand that, you know, if something – you know, if you hide something, that it's not just suddenly gone for good. It's, like, still there, but, you know, you can find it. And so some dogs are really good at physics, and other dogs are much better at this more kind of like what we call, like, the empathy, the eye contact, sort of like solving these social problems. And then there are some dogs, just like there are some people, who are just geniuses at everything. Like, they mm-hmm. can just, you know, they're acing out at all things. And then other dogs have, like, a completely different strategy, and they're much more wolf-like and much more independent, and they're much, you know, less likely to be able to, you know, I guess, solve the kind of problems that we put in front of them. But it's kind of like, it's really not a smart or a dumb dog kind of thing. We don't think about intelligence that way anymore. What we think about is, like, what is the unique cognitive profile of each dog, and what can that tell us about who they will be when they grow up?
You know, it's interesting, as you said, that there are dogs that know more about physics than I ever will. Grady put his head on my foot again. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just playing. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We come back. If y'all have any questions or comments, 504-260-187. I'm getting a lot of questions about housebreaking. Getting a lot of questions about free feeding as opposed to feeding once a day. Got a question, comment here. I saw a video of a big dog blocking the doggy door because an infant was trying to get out of it. It amazes me that the dog knew to do that. And the other thing I do want to address is that they had an incident here a while back where somebody was killed by a pit bull, and also yesterday they broke up a dog fighting ring in an area not too far away from here, and the police officer was just saying it was horrific, and how people can do this, I don't know. But we'll talk about big dogs and kids and everybody getting along and all that stuff as well when we come back. Vanessa Woods, our guest, director of the Puppy Kindergarten at Duke University. The name of the book is Puppy Kindergarten, The New Science of Raising a Great Dog, and it's a fun read. If you're looking for something to take to the beach or a summertime read, even if you don't have a dog, it's interesting just to get into, as Vanessa said, the mind of the dog and see what's going on. 9:37, 23 till 10, traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:43, 17 till 10. Quickly back to Vanessa Woods, director of the Puppy Kindergarten at Duke University. I grew up with German Shepherds, had a Boxer, had Dachshunds for a while, and now I'm on to Grady the Mutt. I don't quite know what he is. Let me get to a couple of questions here if I can. Vanessa Woods, who is the director of the Puppy Kindergarten at Duke University. The book is Puppy Kindergarten. You can get it at all the usual outlets, and it's a fun read. It really is. Somebody said, I have two elderly Yorkies. I cannot get them to eat any dog food, whether it be solid or soft dog food. What do I do?
Oh, no. Little Yorkies, they won't eat any food? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that is not a problem we have at Puppy Kindergarten. All our puppies are ravenously hungry. So that would be definitely a question for your vet. I'm sorry, I cannot help with that one. But I have seen a lot of times, like, dogs who, you know, it almost seems like they have an eating disorder. They either need to be, like, fed a certain way, like, either by hand or, and so I would just ask your vet, are your Yorkies underweight? You know, is it one or both? Are there certain circumstances under which they will eat? Like, is there a time of day? So, I'm sorry I can't help with that one, but it's definitely a conversation for you and your veterinarian.
I love when you go to the big box pet store, because if you go on one side, it's very animal friendly. But if you think about it, when you go to the other side of the store, there's rendered pieces of a different kind of animal, right? You don't realize that, but there are. And I mention that because somebody texted in about their dog being a picky eater, and Grady's that way as well, where, you know, these damn things are expensive. This is $20 a package, and I give him a pig's ear, and he spits it back at me. Why are some dogs pickier than others, and how do you know what, I mean, is that common or not, or is
So there is not a lot of research on eating disorders or, like, you know, funny, fussy eating in dogs. I will say this, though, and that is, this is definitely something that we can learn from service dogs, and that's, like, one of the points of the books. It's like, okay, so, you know, we study these dogs in order to help graduate service dogs, but what we found is that we can really learn a lot about the way that service dogs are raised, bred, and trained for our own dogs. So, for example, service dogs are bred to be hungry. Like, they are bred to be super food motivated because service dog organizations don't use any negative training. Like, there's no punishments, there's no e-collars, and so the dogs have to be motivated to learn. And so this is something that you can breed into a dog, and I think something that we can really focus on in the future and think about is, like, what kind of dog is going to fit into, you know, this general lifestyle that we have. And the culture has really changed. We don't have, you know, we don't tend to hit and beat our dogs just like we don't hit and beat our kids. It's all about positive reinforcement. It's all about, you know, convincing the dog to do, you know, what it is you want. And so what do we need? We need dogs who are food motivated. And that's something that service dogs are really good at. You know, these organizations are really good at breeding into their dogs is, like, a motivation to work for food.
Somebody wrote in, and I hate to even read this text, but they said that they've seen somebody beat a dog with a stick. They've also seen somebody whip it with a stick. They've also seen somebody punch a dog in the mouth when the dog tried to bite at them. And I don't think there's ever a need for physical. To me, it just seems like when you're doing that, then you're begging the dog to fight with you. Or tell me the thoughts of corporal punishment when it comes to dogs or animals or that whole thing.
I mean, I think that, you know, culturally the way that we view dogs has really changed. And now they're really part of our families. And so, you know, we have seen patterns over time that, you know, the culture of dog raising is really following, like, kid raising. So, you know, we don't beat our kids anymore. We found that it's not helpful. And I would say that, you know, for dogs, like, punishment sometimes, you know, really goes the other way and can make a dog worse. And, you know, but it's not just that. It's just the fact that, you know, is it ethically right to beat a dog? I mean, they feel pain, you know, they can suffer. And, you know, there really just has to be a better way to do things, I think. And that's where I think a really good trainer can come in. And then also just managing the expectations of owners. Like, you know, everybody has an idea about the dog they want, just like they have an idea about the kids they want and what they want their kids to grow up to be. But
good luck with that.
Having said that, what's that?
Good luck with that. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, right. And it's like, you know, so we... And the thing that we really try and sort of, like, emphasize in the book is the way that service dog organizations do things. It's like when I was a kid and probably when you were a kid, dogs were just running around the neighborhood. Like, I didn't even know where my dog was, like, half the time when I was away. And I had that kind of childhood, too, like a really free range, like out for the beginning of the day. So, like, and nobody cared where I was as long as I was home by supper, right? And, you know, dogs were the same. But now it's just my kids are super scheduled. You know, they've got a lot more parental involvement, a lot more helicoptering. You know, are they safer? Probably. And the same is true of our dogs. Like, it's really now the dogs are always on leashes. They're never free range. And so it's up to their owners and their parents to make sure they get socialized, to make sure they get to the right puppy classes, to make sure they're eating the right food and doing the right things and can walk nicely on a leash. And so that puts a real, I mean, that requires a whole different set of raising and breeding and training rules than they were even a generation ago, which is really fast for cultural change, I would say.
Somebody
and
texted.
So, you know, yes,
I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead.
I'm not trying to interrupt you. I'm watching the clock,
God,
and I want to get as.
I love it now. You're so sensitive.
I want to get as many questions in as I can. Grady's too busy eating the carpet now. So much for the compassion from him. Somebody texted in about tug of war, and I had a conversation with my own veterinarian, a man I deeply respect, about playing tug of war, and he said it's not necessarily the best thing where you're kind of teaching the dog to be aggressive. So as a result, I have taught Grady, who's a quick learner, to play fetch, to drop it, and then I'll throw it and he'll get it instead of playing tug of war. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't want to disagree with your respected veterinarian.
No, I'm interested
really
in your opinion.
I think it really depends on the dog. So, you know, the service dog organizations we work with, they don't like a lot of tug of war with puppies because when they grow up, they're going to have to do things like hand a lot of things over. Like they're going to have to hand over things. So that's, you know, a particular reason why they don't want to. But just as to like normal pet dogs, I don't see it as being a problem. I mean, it might be annoying if you're trying to play fetch and, you know, the bumper or whatever it is, like the, when they bring it back, they won't give it to you. But I think training can really overcome that. And I think it just depends on the dog.
So somebody texted in, and I'm going to get serious here. Pit bulls are not more aggressive than any other dog. You only hear about pit bull attacks because they do more damage than the smaller, more aggressive dogs. Been a mailman for 25 years and have been attacked by small dogs way more than pit bulls. It can be controversial. It can get political, and that's a shame because it's an animal we're talking about here, and it's science. It's not the animal, I don't think, knows politics one way or the other. But thoughts on pit bulls or specific breeds that you would not have around kids? I know I have a friend I saw with a Cane Corso the other day, beautiful dog, but I don't know that he was in control of the dog. Your thoughts on that, Vanessa?
There is absolutely no scientific research to support that pit bulls are more aggressive than any other dogs. And we have looked extensively into this. It is something that, you know, we advocate for. Number one, people are notoriously bad at identifying the breed of a dog. You know, there's research to show that even people who work in shelters are more often wrong than correct about the breed of a dog when they actually match it to the genetic testing. So, no, pit bulls are not more aggressive than other dogs. You know, any dog with that's kind of like a medium, and also pit bulls are not even a real breed. It's kind of like a collection of three different breeds. But any dog with kind of like short hair of a certain size, you know, if they get bitten and end up at the hospital, you know, if the hospital staff says, you know, was it a pit bull or what was it? And, you know, it's over time, different dogs have been said to be the most aggressive dogs, and there's just no research to support this at all. What is important is the way that dogs are raised, and I just keep saying this, is like the way they are raised, bred, and trained. And so, you know, if you breed a dog to be aggressive, any dog will be aggressive, you know, and we know this from experiments of, you know, with different animal populations. If you breed, you can really easily and quickly breed aggression and friendliness into an animal, and it doesn't matter what that animal is, whether it's like rats or chickens or whatever. And so, you know, what we need to do is we need to breed dogs for friendliness instead of what they look like.
Let me get to the Cane Corso real quick, because I have seen people in the big pet stores with these dogs, and they're not in control of the dog at all. And for people that don't know what a Cane Corso is, imagine a dog that's drawn as a superhero, just extremely muscled and everything else. How important is it with the alpha male thing, Vanessa, where, you know, I guess it might be more important if it's a big dog because the damage could be worse, or how important is it that the dog understands that you're running the show and not the dog?
I don't think the alpha dog metaphor works at all. Okay. I think what we see in feral dogs, dogs who have, you know, just sort of like, you know, exist without any kind of human interference, I mean, they follow the friendliest dog. So, you know, I think the whole alpha male dominant thing doesn't, there's no research to support that. What there is research to support is that, you know, you need consistent, positive training. And a good trainer can help you with that. I don't think it's the actual breed of dogs. I think it's the size of the dog. Like, you're going to be able to scoop up a chihuahua and restrain them much more easily than you are, like, a really large dog. But, I mean, Labrador retrievers can get out of control. Like, I mean, dogs are strong. And so if you have a large dog, then you're going to have to work extensively to train that dog and make sure that they're responsive to you, that you find something that they're motivated to, you know, respond to you for, whether that's food or toys or praise or whatever that is. And if you have a larger dog, you have a burden of responsibility to make sure that that dog is well behaved in public.
I wish I could figure out how to get these Cane Corsos to do bench presses, because they don't have hands, but apparently they do. Vanessa, it's been a pleasure. It really has. I hope you come back. And the book is Puppy Kindergarten. I recommend it as a gift, as just a good summertime read. You're going to enjoy it. The whole family's going to love it. Vanessa Woods, director of the Puppy Kindergarten at Duke University. Please say hello to your husband, because we spoke to him last time, okay?
Thank you so much for having us on the show.
You have a great day. All right, thank you. We'll take a break, come back, find out what Newell's got planned for us today here on WWL.